Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything that we record at vnnforum.com. And today we're going to do another segment of We're Proceeding Subtitle by Subtitle. The Feminization of American Culture, we're in Chapter 4, and we're going to do today Anti-Intellectualism and the Theology of Feeling. So, brain power and mentation yielding to feelings and emotions. Decline of the intellectual rigor of the hardcore Protestantism that founded the United States in the 1600s and 1700s, declining from pretty much 1803, they often date it from the takeover of Harvard, kind of by the more universalist, Unitarian type force, or degraded Calvinism. We're going to trace kind of the decline of Calvinism into less intellectually rigorous, more mass consumer, feminine, beta male feelings and play type of mentality over the course of the 1800s to get where we arrived in the 1900s, the 20th century. Anyway, anti-intellectualism and the theology of feeling. The new view of God's plan and man's part in it, with its stress on emotions, the unconscious, and the resources of leisure and literature, undoubtedly fostered in the clergy an anti-intellectualism, which came in time to have troubling effects on the profession and on the broader culture. As love replaces justice and rigor is replaced by just general sentiment. She says, now this feminist who wrote this admits that that had bad effects. The feminization of American culture had bad effects, this loosening of theological rigor. We heard last time that even back then, when these were in the hardcore vein, they'd take their kids and they would sit in these deep pews they couldn't even really see out of. And they'd listen to very abstract lectures or sermons for hours, for a couple of different sessions on Sunday. That's how serious they were. And so when that declined, it had broader weakening effects in culture. And you can see the connection there. If you're serious about one thing, you're likely to be serious about other things. And that's why the Jews of the Frankfurt School prefer to loosen society. Hey man, whatever floats your boat, whatever turns you on, everything's loose. There's no standards. There's relativism in everything except what touches the Jew agenda, which is absolutes. Moses style commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before diversity and such. Anyway, she came in time to have troubling effects on the profession and on the broader culture. The new view of God's plan and man's part in it, stress and emotions, unconscious, the resources of leisure and literature. We have seen that many ministers, in the midst of their most extravagant statements about the feminine nature of Christianity or the Christ-like role of women, insisted upon female unfitness, indeed incapacity, for the trials and duties of the ministry. In Woman Suffrage, The Reform Against Nature, 1869, parentheses, Bushnell, after saying that men and women could not be more unlike if they were two different species, explains that the male is the, quote, law, thundering forcefully from Sinai, the female the gospel, subject to the law, but bringing grace, quotes. Bushnell then goes on to proclaim the superiority of women, couching her preeminence in terms of the atonement. She, quote, goes above the law in doing everything for it and overtops it in giving by submission to it. Clearly feeling that he has implicitly raised an obvious question, he answers it by saying that women are not to be ministers because, quote, ministration is one thing and the question of administration another. Women lack the brains necessary for executive action. Remember Al Campana saying blacks lack certain necessities for being baseball managers. It's reminiscent of feminine sentimentality. Ignorance of the world, lack of scholarship, precisely those qualities which made women more Christian, and which were named increasingly in any rationale of the liberal ministerial role, were, paradoxically, held against them. So as the ministry is becoming more effeminate, nevertheless, they must keep the women out, but that's not really logically tenable. This apparent contradiction is eloquent. Even while liberal ministers sabotage their intellectual heritage, these are the hard, old-school preachers that you can tell the feminist Anne Douglas who wrote this actually respects, they wish to hold on to it, and they fear that in women and in feminization lay its most formidable antagonist. So, if the ministry is becoming more womanlike, then why wouldn't you want women to lead it? That's kind of an obvious conclusion that they're afraid people are going to draw who might not. If the church is becoming more womanly and Christ is more womanly, and where there's a new role or a new vision of God and His purpose, then why do they need us men ministers? Well, the answer will soon be to some they wouldn't. So they, fearing that, they justify it. They pre-justify it, as she says, clearly feeling he was raised an implicit question, based on this that this new approach would bring out. Women did not attempt to undermine clerical scholarship. As wives and housekeepers, they provided the labor which made it possible. As church members, they constituted the audience which received its fruits and sermons, prayers and discourses. As intelligent and sensitive individuals, many of them exerted an important and constructive influence over the thinking of their ministerial husbands and friends. Yet, as we have seen, disbelief in female capacity for scholarship and real intellectual or artistic achievement was widespread in American culture. The clergy, anxious to preserve their claim to distinction from those they imitated, fostered such skepticism. Its effects on women and on their attitude toward religion were largely and predictably negative. The gravest irony of the minister's position was precisely that in defending themselves, they armed their enemy. The reactions of the two most talented Beecher sisters to the pervasive, clerically endorsed misogyny of their society were representative, if extreme. Both women were unusually well-versed and interested in Protestant theology. Both played a major role in vitiating its intellectual content. Their options were painfully limited. In Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel, My Wife and I, the frivolous Ava Van Arsdale is set against her older sister, Ida. Ava, as I have noted, is a pretty little coquette. She reads little besides magazines and likes to get her, quote, ideas by talking to men who have read more than she. Her, quote, study, unquote, boasts few books and is decorated to give the illusion of what Eva calls, quote, my Italy. The room sports copies of works by Bushnell's favorite painter, Fra Angelico. At one point, Ava explains her Anglican faith with a superficiality which fascinates and horrifies. Quote, I long for the dear old prayers of my church, where my poor, naughty little heart has learned the way and can go on with full consent without stopping to think. End quote. Ida Van Arsdale, in contrast, is doctrinally free-thinking, but temperamentally a Puritan. She fixes up her study like a room in an old New England farmhouse. Scholarly, bright, hard-working, Ida is determined to be a doctor and a lifelong spinster. She is clearly the more admirable of the two sisters, yet Stowe pretty much drops her from consideration in We and Our Neighbors book, the sequel to My Wife and I. Stowe chooses to focus her attention, with whatever ambivalence, on the feminine opponent rather than on the feminist upholder of the New England way, which you can well imagine that Anne Douglas sees herself. You would assume Douglas would be like a, well, maybe Scottish, but certainly could be an English, maybe a Puritan name herself. One can hardly falter. Stowe society had given her little incentive or hope in plotting Ida's future. Ida was the rare exception, not the rule. And unlike her equally improbable, saintly fictional predecessors, Ida's appeal to readers was limited. Stowe as a novelist and a person was far too sociologically alert. Remember, this is the woman who wrote the book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. You're the woman who wrote the little book that started the war, I think is what Lincoln said to her. She was far too sociologically alert, Harriet Beecher Stowe, indeed almost punitively so, to waste her time on sheer high-mindedness, that is, promoting the ideal of the woman as scholar against the social mores of the time. Harriet's own sister, Catherine, at first glance seems closer to Ida than Ava. Easily the intellectual equal of her most brilliant brother, Edward, Catherine Beecher was capable of producing theological tracts which, if published anonymously with no hint of the sex of the author, won the respect and response of some of America's ablest divines. As a young woman, however, while her brothers went to Yale or Amherst, she stayed at home. Her adult life was spent in an ever-sanguine, that is cheerful, ever-frustrated search to raise the funds necessary to endow a women's college, staffed by women and designed to satisfy her biased yet high standards. Beecher was too restless ever to become truly bitter, but her heart burned at times when she contemplated the magnificent financial resources of Harvard and Yale and thought of her own multiple failed educational endeavors. Despite her temperamental self-righteousness, very common among these Puritans, and excitability, her claim that she could have succeeded if she had only had more money seems a fair one. A good portion of her frantic overactivity was an effort to substitute human ingenuity for economic backing. Beecher suffered from hysteria and occasional paralytic afflictions. One hardly needs recourse to psychoanalysis to sense that she was suppressing a massive hatred of the male world which had denied her colleges, denied her, in a very real sense, her mind. All Catherine Beecher's antagonism surfaced in an extraordinary book published in 1850 entitled Truth Stranger Than Fiction. This work purported to be a defense of Delia Bacon, 1811-59, formerly Catherine's student at the Hartford Female Seminary, later a talented lecturer and writer somewhat in the line of Margaret Fuller. Bacon had been engaged to Alexander McWhorter, M-A-C-W-H-O-R-T-E-R, a Yale graduate, a minister, and a man significantly younger than herself. In 1847, McWhorter had rather humiliatingly refused to marry her. At this time, Delia's brother Leonard, a distinguished New Haven preacher and a Yale professor of divinity, had brought McWhorter to trial for breach of faith before the local Connecticut convocation, and had lost the case. So how about that? That's how much more serious they were back then than we are today. Regardless of what you think about what they actually were serious about, which was somewhat some clownish Christian theology, which can neither be proved nor settled ever, which is why there's so many endless disputes over it. No one disputes that water freezes at 32 degrees. And if there were a dispute, how would they test it? See, that's the difference between Christianity and actual knowledge, which is science. Never allow people to put revelation on the same par as science. Science can be faked and wrong, whatever, but there's a means to tell the true from the false, whereas in religion, no matter what any conservative tells you, there is no way to separate opinion from fact. So it cannot be put on a par on the same level as science. It simply cannot be, no matter they claim that's a leftist position. Revelation is not the equal of reason or of established scientific fact. It is a very, very poor shirt tail cousin to it. It is, in fact, mere opinion. Both McWhorter and Bacon enlisted backers whose interest was not sparked solely by Delia Bacon's plight. The contest was in reality one between the older ministers, many of them colleagues or pupils of Lyman Beecher's closest friend, Nathaniel Taylor, and the younger clergymen, led by Bacon. The former were professors and theologians. The latter were chiefly less learned men from the county parishes. Catherine Beecher contributed two lawyers and herself to the trial, and then wrote her indignant account of it. She was fully aware that the conflict was between what Edwards A. Park would call, quote, the theologian, unquote, and, quote, the pastor. Interesting distinction there. And her book was assertively dedicated to the parochial clergy, quote unquote, of America. She knew that she was attacking not just, as she melodramatically emphasized, quote, the gray hairs of my father's friend, Taylor, that is, but the Calvinist intellectual tradition and the elitist male institution most heavily endowed for its propagation. Her rally cry was the sanctity of the domestic claims which McWhorter had violated and which Yale University, in exonerating him, had despised. Interesting use of the word despised there. She was positive that the adverse decision could only have been the result of a, quote, malignant conspiracy. But she was determined, as she told Leonard Bacon, to oppose it, quote, such a woman with such a calumny affixed to her by such men is, and must be, the center of a perpetual warfare. There is no peace to her, or to one whose destiny is now united with hers, till this wrong, as far as it can be, is righted. Unquote. Unfortunately, to Delia Bacon's distress, Beecher kept her word. If she did not alleviate Delia Bacon's situation, she did express her rage and display her revengeful alliance with the forces of sentimental morality against those of theological scholarship. The most serious motive for her rage is one she omits from the book. Critics laughed at the excess of Beecher's tirade, yet her anger was admirable. The fact that she had little constructive advice to offer was the best justification of her passion. She had been barred all her life from access to the training necessary to fully solve the problems she exposed. So Douglas is no doubt identifying with this woman and saying, look, she had the intellectual ability to do this stuff. She was denied purely because of her sex, and that is unfair. And there's probably not too much to argue about that. I mean, if someone is truly exceptional mentally, the fact that they're of one sex, a woman, doesn't really matter that much. They should be able to go ahead and study and increase their natural advantage and add something to the world. I see no problem with that at all. The problem comes in when you promote average women who are not inclined intellectually into going to college instead of becoming mothers, which they're much more suited for. The problem is not the 5% minority that are actually way ahead of things. The forces of anti-intellectualism Catherine Beecher invoked were destined to win the day in clerical ranks. In 1853, a few years after Beecher's outburst, Bella Bates Edwards of Andover Seminary lamented that people considered, quote, an intellectual clergyman deficient in piety and an eminently pious ministry deficient in intellect. So piety and intellect are seen as at odds. Clerical ability to unite piety with intellect, and thus to win wide respect, came to seem more and more elusive. By 1883, President Eliot of Harvard could say that the ministry had declined greatly in the preceding 40 years, principally because educated men no longer found the, quote, intellectual qualities, unquote, in the clergy which they expected in a guide. One clear sign of the dilemma of the ministry was the increasingly youthful age of men assuming pastorates. By the mid-19th century, especially in large towns, congregations tended to select men in their 30s, often more youthful than the most influential members of their church. In 1859, Reverend C. Van Santvoord, like a nice Dutch name there, president of the Synod of the Dutch Reformed Churches, complained, quote, churches of present time show so strong a proclivity toward calling young men in preference to teachers of a riper experience and more solid attainments that a man happening to be prematurely bald or gray may reckon on almost certain discomfiture when competing with a younger candidate. In Van Santvoord's opinion, S-A-N-T-V-O-O-R-D, churches hope thus to pay little, to get men up with the times, and to have a, quote, a fair countenance, unquote, to contemplate on Sunday morning. So someone young, dumb, good-looking, by comparison with the old types, provide a superior entertainment for these congregations. Rather than worrying about their soul, they're more worried about being entertained after at a good value, you see? And this would be the natural human tendency. Congregations were seeking in their ministers the ideal of feminine labor, namely youth, good looks, and cheapness. They were ensuring the lack of lengthy training and also characteristic of women employees, even though their preachers are men. Seminaries inevitably reflected congregational demands. And that would just be the demands of the congregation. That's just the adjectival form of congregation. Seminaries inevitably reflected congregational demands. Between 1850 and 1895, the number of Yale's graduates doubled, yet the proportion of those who entered the ministry decreased by more than 60%. Of those who joined the clergy, fewer came from the best colleges, fewer came from colleges at all. Within the seminaries themselves, whether Harvard or Andover or Yale, there was a shift of emphasis and requirements for ministerial candidates, which presupposed a change in theological outlook, at least correspondent to the altered intellectual level of the young men applying to such schools. So they're dropping standards and changing standards. In 1726, the massively well-read Cotton Mather, Pilgrim's Progress, remember, writing his Manductio ad Ministerium, parentheses, directions for a candidate of the ministry, said that he believed, quote, learning, unquote, of a general kind, the second most important qualification for a clergyman after piety. How about that? Now, that's a good statement of intellectual values made before the decline of all this in the earlier days. He says, the first thing a clergyman must be is pious. He must believe. He must behave like he believes. But the second thing, he must have very wide, general knowledge. He recommended that a well-trained minister should know Latin, Greek, Hebrew, rhetoric, logic, natural philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and divinity. That's kind of the classical Roman education, right? Or Greek. The purpose of all this erudition was clear to Mather. He stressed that, quote, it is of the last importance that the candidate should be a good casuist, that is, an arguer. Mather was extolling the inquisitional and controversial skills Hopkins and Emmons possessed in such eminence. That is, they're able to argue their case, they're able to persuade people, they're able to lay out what they're talking about very persuasively to bring others around. They're not there to amuse them like a clown or be good looking. They're focusing on what's actually human rather than the animal middle, you know, limbic system appeals to basic lusts. Visual desires are appealing to your intellect, and this is why the first generations in America were the best ones we ever had, because they were higher quality people for whatever reason. So Mather was extolling the inquisitional, inquiring into something, and controversial, controverting something, arguing something, skills that Hopkins and Emmons possessed in such eminence, the ability to discriminate false from true and defend the correct against the incorrect. Good things, huh? Mather assumed that the truth was to be had if with difficulty, labor, and argumentation. You got to find your way to the truth, sift through competing claims, use solid doctrine, and then try to reason from it or to it. Emmons and Hopkins, who trained hundreds of young ministers in the days before seminaries opened, upheld Cotton Mather's standards. So, Cotton Mather, Emmons, and Hopkins, these are some of the old school names. Now listen to this. They themselves labored 12 hours daily at their desks. Their impractical absent-mindedness about affairs of this world, in which antiquarians would delight, was cultivated, not innate. Emmons refused to work in his garden lest it distract him from the more urgent responsibilities. He believed that the duties God required of men were so many and so diverse that the true Christian would find no time for mere amusements. Emmons had no concept of leisure. Little wonder if, according to popular lore, such men occasionally rode off on the wrong horse after service, or even occasionally made themselves at home in the wrong house. They had much more important things on their minds than such mundane distinctions. Reverends West, Whitridge, and Hopkins used to meet together regularly and talk theology for hours. On one occasion, just as night fell, Whitridge came out to see West to his horse. They fell again into theological debate and were absorbed until they thought they detected a fire in the east. It was the rising sun. So again, this is how serious these people were about. They were dead serious about it. And that's how they were able to develop a high and impressive culture. Because they were intellectually serious, even the stuff they were serious about was somewhat clowny, as I would say. And it calls to mind someone like Pierce working full-time and worrying about racial stuff and able to produce high-quality material that trained, or if not trained, but educated thousands of people like me, who knew nothing but, you know, semi-intellectual, soft, emotion-driven Jew taking over conservatism. You see, this so the value comes, even if what they're arguing about is not specifically true. There's good value in thinking about these things very carefully and learning how to argue and learning how to express oneself. This is part of what it is to be white. And we look for things we can admire in white culture. And this is one example of it, as it was manifest in these early, very intelligent, very rigorous, very hardworking Protestant preachers. Timothy Dwight, heir of Jonathan Edwards by lineal descent, and by creed, that is, descended by him, I guess, literally, or at least in he was in his preaching line. I'm not sure if that's literal or metaphorical, but by creed, he believed the same things. As a tutor at Yale in the late 18th century, pursued the ascetic commitment to learning which had characterized his predecessors. He limited himself to two mouthfuls of food at dinner, usually potatoes, slept on the floor, and studied heroically long hours. Probably partially as a result of this regimen, he almost lost the use of his eyes. In later years, he was never able to work for prolonged periods of time. He professed to be thankful, since he had been forced to the discovery that, quote, real knowledge, unquote, was only to be drawn from life. His style as a teacher and a preacher, training future ministers at Yale, was consequently very different from that of his forebears. In the words of a contemporary, Timothy Dwight, quote, broke up the metaphysical mode of discussion so prevalent at that time in the pulpit and introduced a more popular and instructive method of address, unquote. One can hardly regret Dwight's partial loss of vision. It led to the masterly Travels in New England and New York book. Travels in New England and New York. Dwight's shrewd practical powers of observation are displayed to the fullest in this lively narrative, which is far superior by almost any criterion to his dull, if solid, four-volume treatise, Theology Explained and Defended. Dwight's changed course undeniably marks, however, an unwitting turn in the New England Calvinist tradition. Increasingly after Dwight, ministers were pastors, even writers, before they were theologians. Interesting. So they changed from... So their pastor means you're kind of attending to the people, or you're writing books, rather than worrying about the science of studying God, theology. The fate of Andover Seminary illustrates the shift in American Protestantism away from dispute, doctrine, and scholarship. Founded in 1808 as a bastion against Harvard, which had recently capitulated to the then-insurgent Unitarian forces, like we said, that was in 1803, Andover was intended to preserve and perpetuate the New Light Divinity, capital NLD, New Light Divinity of Edwards and Hopkins. All professors at the school swore opposition not only to atheists and infidels, but to Jews, Papists, Mohammedans, Arians, A-R-I-A-N-S, that's an early heresy, Pelagians, another heresy, Antinomians, Socinians, Sabellians, Unitarians, and Universalists. They renewed this oath in public once every 5 years. Students, conducted through a supremely rigorous course which heavily emphasized biblical exegesis, that's interpretation, indubitably essential to developing controversial skills, were examined once by a year by trustees, visitors, and faculty, also in public. So how about that? They're going through a very rigorous study in order that they can oppose, successfully out-argue, all these various heresy schools, and as well as Jews, Catholics, and Mohammedans, or Muslims, and atheists and infidels. So they cover the full gamut of people they can out-argue, and they're forced to essentially defend themselves in public. This keeps them very sharp, you would imagine. Good stuff, good stuff. The stronger my enemies are, the better for me, right? If I can be better than them, then I'm better than I was. And this is the way of evolution in matters intellectual as well as in matters genetic, right? The clear assumption was that the theological truth was indeed a fortress, but one in constant need of defense. Moses Stuart, who taught at Andover, delivered his learned broadsides against the Unitarians in the earlier part of the century. Other, more liberal scholars like Edwards A. Park and Calvin Stowe were to succeed him at the task of ingenious debate. Calvin Stowe reiterated emphatically in 1852 that, quote, the right interpretation of Scripture, unquote, was the cornerstone of religion. But students did not always agree. By the 1870s, students, abetted by the younger members of the faculty, demanded and got less biblical exegesis in their middle years. Park, after a long and unsuccessful struggle against their demands, which his own liberalism had unwittingly fostered, resigned in 1881, unable to appoint the Hopkinsian scholar he wished to see in his place. He was destined to spend the next 20 years working on a never-assembled biography of Jonathan Edwards. The students' revolt against biblical criticism was crucial because it revealed their endorsement of Orville Dewey's observation that, quote, the almost exclusive object of the modern pulpit is religious impression. The great revivalist preacher Edward Payson, P-A-Y-S-O-N, of Maine, was reputed to believe that, quote, doctrine should be like sugar and tea, only tasted in the cup. And who needed a full year of close biblical study just to provide flavor? Even the biblical criticism which Park and others had gone to Germany to study, the new higher criticism that was, failed to take hold in America. In 1847, the scholar George Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, published a despairing article in the Christian Examiner entitled, quote, Causes of the Decline of Interest in Critical Theology. Noyes concluded that seminaries might fail for lack of public support. Andover, like Harvard and Yale, survived, but the preoccupation of later generations of divinity students was increasingly to be either with themselves and the cult of self-nurture, or with the changing, conflict-laden world and the creed of the social gospel, not with the learned expression of the Holy Scriptures. So, they go from the old school, extremely intense. This is kind of like in literary criticism. What was it called? Like New Criticism came in after, I forget the different schools, but it came in the first half of the 20th century. The New Criticism, very close attention to the text, textual interpretation. This is kind of rigorous interpretation of the text. And this is kind of parallel to the original Protestantism. You had men of very high IQ, very closely studying the Bible, as we've been heard, for long hours in order to interpret it correctly, and believing that this correct exegesis, this correct interpretation, is the key to understanding the Scriptures. Just in another parallel, someone is really studying the Constitution. What did they mean? Most of it you can understand by reading what they mean, but some of it, if you don't, you understand the context it came out of and what they meant by any particular phrases that might seem a little unclear. And this is the best way to go about it. I believe that myself. I would be of the old school, of course. You know that. But the new people, that's a little hard. We want something more entertaining. It's all about me and how I feel and growing my own character. Well, that could be valid as well as invalid. And then it's also about social gospel, doing good here in the world. And that came in more the end of the 1800s, as I recall. Murray Rothbard has written about that quite enlighteningly, the late dead Jew libertarian, the social gospel, and how Protestantism through this process declined into that. And that is what we're discussing. But this is not so much a political book. It's more about these preachers, the set of preachers and some of these lines and how their thinking changed over the generations, the forces doing battle. In 1850, Park himself had instigated the second major 19th century controversy among the liberal Protestant clergy over their intellectual role. The first had occurred in 1839 when the Transcendentalist Unitarians of Boston and Cambridge, led by Ralph Waldo Emerson, George Ripley and Orestes Brownson, split from their more orthodox Unitarian brethren, ably marshaled by Andrews Norton of Harvard Divinity School. Norton was a parishioner of Henry Ware Sr., a Brahmin intellectual, possessed of a genuine, if conventional, acumen. His dedication to scholarship and reason was extreme for, as a fervent social conservative, in these alone he found potentially civilizing forces for the democratic chaos around him. It was characteristic of the man and his spirit that his son, Charles Eliot Norton, very ill at 10, worried only that he would die and not be able to, quote, edit father's works. Norton was bitterly opposed to transcendental subjectivity and the incipiently democratic notion, as he put it, quote, that the mind possessed a faculty of intuitively discerning the truths of religion. Utterly distrustful of the common people, or even the less common people, he wished to see, quote, religion, dot, 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 taken out of the hands of divines, and its exposition and defense, become the study of philosophers as being the highest philosophy. These philosophers were to possess, quote, extensive learning. Let me tell you, whites admire extensive learning for its own sake, not for the money it can bring. This is a key, fundamental Germanic principle that has driven our race through the ages, and this must be understood by these. This is what a white education is. It begins, even if you cannot be an intellect at the highest level, and how few among us can be, that is what you respect. Great learning is something that is always respectable. It is very, very deeply respected in German culture, and we are all mostly Germanic-type people. So you should have that deep respect for learning, not for the money that you make from it, but for the learning itself. You should. These philosophers were to possess extensive learning. Norton's response to the implicit attack on the clergy's elite status was, as his transcendental opponents fully recognized, to become more elite, to assert the challenged claims even more assertively. No, we shouldn't drop standards. If anything, we should raise standards. The historian Richard Hildreth, one of Norton's ablest critics, realized that Norton was essentially arguing that, quote, religion consists in knowledge. How these people would view the 20th century Christian religion and its exemplars and its lay people, and how they would laugh at it.
Have you accepted Jesus as your personal savior?
That's like sub-kindergarten for special needs retards versus what we're talking about here, people who can study the Bible 12 hours a day and exegete their way out of a a bubble wrapped, you know, tiny plastic bag, you know. They can exegete their way out of Houdini-like coils and chains and locks because they know what they're talking about because they've read it and they've thought about it to a very high degree to where they don't even notice the night's disappeared and the sun's coming up. That's how much they cared and that's how much effort they put into it. The case was very different for Park, who was 22 years younger, considerably more brilliant and infinitely more imaginative, although every bit as scholarly as Norton, and equally concerned about the clergy's dwindling intellectual stature. Norton was slated to be a partisan, a self-believer, able to defend and see only one side of a historical conflict. Park was destined by temperament and talent to attempt to bridge the fissures of his culture, the divisions. He tolerated intellectual mediocrity with great difficulty. When a student, after delivering a peculiarly spiritless and dull sermon, asked Park what hymn would best accompany it, Park snapped back with the acerbic irony which Puritan discipline fostered and could not always check. Quote, "Now I lay me down to sleep, I think might go well with that young man." Isn't that great? They knew they, and this is the funny thing. I there's definitely parallels in my own life because I would let that run freely, whereas like some of the people I'm descended from who are very much in this line would check it. But I'm less concerned with being respectable, perhaps, than they are. Oh, this is marvelous stuff, I think. All right, back to the text. Driven abroad by the nervous prostration and insatiable curiosity which would dog him all his days, he experienced a profound depression in Germany. the advanced biblical scholarship. Now remember, back then, the people who were, there was basically no PhD in America until, I don't know, at some point in the 1800s, but before then there really wasn't one. And some of these students, a lot through the middle course of the 1800s, would go over to Germany and get their PhD and come back to the U.S. and spread some of those doctrines. And in Germany, there was the higher criticism, which was sort of a taking Bible claims and doing a close textual analysis for historical accuracy, trying to trace these things back to something real. And this is the source of a lot of liberalism, actually. It sounds like there's nothing wrong with it, but it tended to develop into non-belief because they couldn't prove a lot of it, which, after all, may be the truth, right? He experienced a profound depression in Germany. The advanced biblical, this is the higher criticism, the advanced biblical scholarship and the extensive libraries he found there made him ashamed and afraid for a provincial Andover. So the Germans are ahead of them in this. Like Cotton Mather, he firmly believed that a minister who filled, to his mind, the greatest place in God's creation ought to know everything. He intensely admired Moses Stuart, a colleague who exemplified the martyrdom and the glory of a learned clergy. Block quote here. A Christian scholar, contending with the infirmities of an emaciated body, leaving his sleepless couch that he may discipline himself for the studies of an anxious day, and closing his volume at evening that he may gain some intermittent sleep for the relief of his wearied frame, keeping aloof from the haunts of men, that he may search out new motives for winning them to a life of godliness. Well, hell, that's something you can respect, even if you don't believe in the same thing. They took it seriously. They believed their own bullshit, as you know I love to put it. They acted like they believed what they were saying, and that makes anyone compelling. At least if we reject him, we take him seriously. You see? These are not clowns. Someone like Joel Osteen grinning with gleaming white teeth, that's a clown. That's not a serious person. These were serious people. Stuart had indeed kept aloof, and Park could not finally accept this as a valid alternative for the modern minister. In his memoirs of Hopkins and Emmons, whose scholarship Park helped to make legendary, he dwells fascinatedly on the inability of either man to attract a broad audience. Both achieved their impact in a manner traditional for a member of an intellectual elite, by educating students who were able to spread their doctrines as they themselves were incapable of doing, so the teacher of the teachers. Park was impressed by their ability to adhere to and believe in truth without the confirmation supplied by followers. He perhaps exaggerates their isolation to throw into bolder relief the fine quality of their intellectual integrity. They had no need, no conception of a public in the modern sense. Yet at the same time, it is clear they weren't building crystal palaces. They were doing fine and high intellectual work, teaching it to the elite of the elite, and these elite were going out and spreading their doctrines, hopefully, or that's the idea anyway. Not everyone can reach a mass audience. You got to reach the people who are on the level you are on. And then other people will popularize it or spread simpler versions of it if it seems good to them. Yet at the same time, it is clear that Park finds such pristine and tenacious virtue in itself a guarantee of very limited popularity. He keeps stressing that both men put their beliefs harshly, boldly. He hovers between an apology for such tactless and impolitic overstatedness and an admission that a minister cannot say what he believes to be the truth and appeal. And again, and I swear to you, I can feel this in my bones. Almost, they're being almost deliberately perverse in making their stuff unappealing so that even if you totally dislike what I'm saying and you think me disagreeable and obnoxious and hateful and evil, yet that which I am saying will perdure because it is true. It, in a backwards way, it underlines the strength of the material that you can shit and crap all over and make it as ugly as possible, and God damn it, there's still something there that can't be gainsaid, no matter the manner of its presentation. It's obviously a wonderful, true thing. And you get a feeling that this is kind of what was going on. Not to that degree, of course, but just simply they're overlooking obvious sugary appeals. Just say, here's the plain meat of this doctrine. You eat that. Damn, that's good stuff. doesn't need any dressing or any gravy or anything. Just eat that, just plain. It doesn't even need any salt. It's so flavorful, flavorous, delicious, good stuff. You know? And isn't that how we feel when we read something? We read a deep, someone who has a deep understanding of something. We come to light ourselves by its fire, you know, and we feel what it's conveying to us. Now he says, he keeps stressing that both men put their beliefs harshly, boldly. He hovers between an apology for such tactless and impolitic overstatedness and an admission that a minister cannot say what he believes to be the truth and appeal. Everywhere he implies that no Latter-day minister could fully follow their relentless course. Park himself was a powerful revivalist preacher who was able to awe and thrill even Emily Dickinson, a superb scholar whose biographies and studies still stand. He solved the clerical problem of his generation in his own life. Yet he was always pressed by that urge which tormented and inspired Matthew Arnold to make the, quote, best culture prevail. He was always searching for a way to democratize what he hardly recognized as his own achievement, always anxious to rationalize and make accessible a clerical creed and lifestyle which would permit both learning and popularity, or in his terms, quote, intellect and feeling. So the masses like the feeling and the elite like the intellect. And you can see how the harder core stuff would make more sense when life was harder core and death was closer. When they first showed up in the shores, there were few people. The winters were extremely rough. This old hardcore rigor would make more sense. Now, when you get to the 1800s already, you have a lot more options for spending your time. So entertainment and production values figure in. You have a bigger menu of options than listening to a guy two times talk for 2 hours on a Sunday. And thus, to the extent the church remains a choice, it's going to liberalize and become more fun and more sugary, you see. Obviously to a much less degree than today, but still to a greater degree than in 1700 to 1800. Liberal, more options, more entertainment, more Sunday school, you know, all this stuff. Rock bands, now we have youth pastors, that kind of thing. It does seem that hard times breed hard, strong, tough people, and soft times reverse. Now let's see. His religious and intellectual ideal was in the best sense a bisexual one for both sexes, and he wished it to be not an isolated ideal, but part of Christian practice. He failed finally in this aim, but his failure is one of the most interesting phenomena in the history of 19th century American theology, if only because, occurring in such a quarter, it demonstrates that success was hardly possible anywhere. Park knew that to engage men's minds is to enlist their hearts. He said so and demonstrated so, but in his numerous writings about the clergy, he repeatedly sets up or recognizes a split between the two faculties. As so many of the ministers of his time were able to do, Park envisioned and longed for a theology in which virile energy, masculine, manly energy, was to be united with refined sensibility. In a crucial address entitled The Theology of the Intellect and the Theology of the Feelings, delivered in 1850, he described the former as precise logical doctrines developed and supported by the reason, and the latter as the form of belief, quote, suggested by and adapted to the wants of the well-trained heart. In a telling illustration, he linked the first with a father, the second with a mother. Of course, some version of this distinction had been familiar to Christian theology since the church fathers. It is the definition and respective value Park gives the terms, which is striking. Although Park's ostensible purpose is to argue that there are two are both indispensable to the Christian minister, the two are both indispensable to the Christian minister, the mother and the father aspect, who must have, quote, all the sensibility of a woman without becoming womanish, and all the perspicacity of a logician without being merely logical. His opening remark stresses that the appeal to the heart and the imagination can be successful when the reason and judgment have been addressed in vain. And throughout, his special plea is for the feelings. So it's just like, anything that's, you know, Guns N' Roses, that has the masculine and the feminine element, and working together, they can get farther than either one could alone. Park's discourse was at once recognized as epoch-making and controversial, and few were unaware which theology had emerged the victor, the theology of feelings. A reviewer for the Christian Examiner applauded Park, obviously thinking that he expressed agreement with the Andover leader. He wrote, quote, "We are free to confess that much as we honor logic and the intellect, we would prefer a hymn book and a heart." And you can see, you should be able to see through this chapter how this will degrade even further 100 years later into, oh, well, God loves all the little children of the world, import Somalis for profit into Minnesota. Charles Hodge, a brilliant Presbyterian theologian at Princeton Seminary and the self-chosen defender of orthodoxy, in the lengthy and stunning debate which ensued between Park and himself, showed himself not only disapproving of Park, but more aware of the implications of Park's argument than Park himself. He's like, okay, you want to value the theology of feelings? Well, here's where it's going to lead. You don't even see it, but I do. Ironically, sounding a great deal like the deceased Emmons, remember, that's one of the like with Hoskins, one of the followers of Jonathan Edwards in the solid old school, whom Park venerated, Hodge insisted that one theology must be true, the other false, or there could be no explicit or implicit contest between them. He was doggedly conscious that Park, in most un-Calvinist fashion, was refusing to choose, and in doing so, quote, enabling a man to profess what he does not believe. He was convinced that Park was finally, from no matter what motives, fostering sentimentality, allowing people to regret what they themselves have destroyed, to confuse fact with fiction. In his single most penetrating thrust, he accused Park of believing that the central tenets of the Protestant creed were, quote, merely intense expressions, while Hodge knew them to be true as doctrines. Hodge argued that Park was not so much impressing literature into the service of religion as turning religion into literature. He believed that the escape Park was trying to find for himself was that of language. Emmons and Hopkins, by Park's own account, were men capable of few linguistic effects and interested in fewer. They're here for the they're here for the logic and the doctrine. They're not here for any sound effects or production values or rhetoric. Emmons asserted, "I never thought of my style. I wrote as I thought." Jacob Ide, IDE, Emmons's 19th century editor, speaking of Emmons' style, praised its perspicacity. His thoughts were perfectly naked, able to see through clearly. Emmons was a man absolutely sure that he had, quote, obtained certainty upon all points which would admit of it, unquote, and few, apparently, did not. He wanted his thoughts, quote, naked, unquote, precisely because he knew the thoughts were there, and he wanted them in the spotlight. Hard to argue with that school. That's definitely my school. Park called attention to the words, in Hodge's opinion, because he was substituting them for the thoughts. There is undeniable evidence for Hodge's interpretation. Park said openly that the theology of the feelings provides visible and tangible images, quote-unquote, rather than abstract thoughts, unquote, that it is suited not to controversy but to poetry. And he continually implied that the scriptures offer imaginative language, not statements of facts, that the Bible is a literary text. He came perilously close to saying that religion is a metaphor. See, now the Bible presents itself as the literal, historical, and other truth. It's written by God. He has commandments. There's nothing. It's not like Aesop's fables or the Hausmärchen, house stories collected by the Brothers Grimm that may teach lessons or fables or moral parables, but the Bible is claiming to be something absolutely true. So, is it just literature, or is it what it purports itself to be? In a passage which perhaps shows the influence of Bushnell's Coleridgean treatment of language in God and Christ, 1849, God in Christ, 1849, Park explains that, quote, Liberal doctrines of theology are too vast for complete expression by man, and our intensest words are but a distant approximation to that language which forms the new song that the redeemed in heaven sing. Park is acknowledging the timeless truth that expression cannot match realization. He is also subscribing to more specific romantic notions of the inexactness and richness of language. Hodge charges that this is a credo more suitable for a poet than a minister. Hodge metaphorically pulls the rug out from under Park. He denies to Park the consolation of aesthetics. He asserts the ugliness and primacy of dogma. He accuses Park in several brilliant phrases of, quote, playing with words, of performing pirouettes on words. Park is substituting the leisured art of literature for laborious commitment to truth. It is the same issue we have already seen in the changing concepts of the atonement and of the conversion process. God does not assimilate to man, nor man to God, easily or pleasantly or beautifully, Hodge insists. Sobriety, struggle, pain, the intense awareness that comes with realization and ratiocination. Not laced with emotion, the bareness of plain facts. Again, think of these beautiful, unadorned Puritan churches. They're the very opposite of the Catholic, ornate, mystical type stuff. Just the intellectual rigor is there. Whereas Mencken would say, you know, the reason the Catholics are right, if you reduce the Bible to some sonorous phrases and some, you know, the smell swinging from the censer that they're waving around, that is, if you get rid of that and reduce it to reading the Bible, the magic and the mystery are lost. So this is kind of the argument that's going on. But of course, we being from that school will more respect the, to me, churches are garish and overdone. The cathedrals are basically ridiculous. But they may be impressive architecturally, but in terms of taste and style, they're overdone. But then I do come from these Puritans, and I admire that if it's in you, you don't need to have it in the externals and the ornaments. It's right there in the naked wood furniture. This is the equivalent of naked wood versus an overstuffed armchair that would be the Catholic Church, you see. This is a plain pew, someone here lecturing you and telling you what, by God, you need to hear. You see? So these are the kind of the two aesthetic schools doing, or one aesthetics goes naturally with one intellectual approach, and the other goes with the other. I think you should see that. So Hodge is saying, no, buddy, you're playing around with words. You're trying to evade. You're trying not to choose. You're trying to deny the dogma and turn it all into poetry. But he's saying, Hodge insists, sobriety, struggle, pain, this is not an easy thing. This is a hard thing. The intense awareness that comes with realization, oh, God, I'm a sinner. Well, what have I got to do to get right? I've got to accept this truth about myself, and I've got to accept the truth about what I need to do. And only then do I have a ghost of a chance. This is what he's saying. He's saying it's not an easy thing. It's not what Park is saying it is. Sobriety, struggle, pain, the intense awareness. You know, these aren't pleasant things. These are difficult things. The church is not here to be your happy fun center. It's here to help you with this extremely difficult problem of life. And give you the answer that no matter how painful or difficult, is it precisely and only what you need and thus need to hear. Sobriety, struggle, pain, the intense awareness that comes with realization and ratiocination, not laced with emotion, the bareness of plain facts, are essential ingredients in the genuine religious experience and calling. This is no cheap Catholic run in and confess to Padre McFeely. This is something much more serious and hardcore. Heavier. It's heavier than Catholicism. Much, much heavier. Hodge indubitably had logic on his side. But it's also harder to maintain. And we're talking about the degradation of this more serious doctrine, a more serious people. Again, in the fiction, we've heard Jones talk about in other places we've done audiobooks on, The Scarlet Letter and Nathaniel Hawthorne. and the seriousness with which those people took their morality, much more than we do today. Hodge indubitably had logic on his side. He was in the invincible position of meaning exactly what he said and being fully aware that his opponent did not. Hodge was incapable of seeing the sincerity and importance of Park's effort to revitalize dogma with the creative forces of literature. Hodge himself here and elsewhere seems to have issued a personal veto against the imaginative life. And remember, these Puritans, they didn't have time for frippery. They didn't even celebrate like Christmas, a lot of them, or at least for a long time. They didn't really believe in birthdays or Christmas. Like today, I think Seventh-day Adventists still don't do that. They saw it as kind of frivolous. So this was a thoroughgoing cultural theme among these Puritans. Yet he correctly saw the drift of Park's thinking. His essentially institutional mind apprehended the potential over-personalism of Park's approach. It's too subjective. It's not founded on anything solid. It's just whatever you feel is right is how this could ultimately degrade into, and that's what it did. Cafeteria Christians, you just believe whatever makes you comfortable. Christianity is not about what makes you comfortable, pal. God issued commandments, not suggestions. As has been said, this stuff is true. It is apodictic. It is necessarily true. And you don't just, I don't have a little of that and a little of that. I don't really feel like having any of that. That's not how it works, man. Now, yet he correctly saw the drift, Hodge did, of Park's thinking. His essentially institutional mind. Now, what implications will this doctrine that Park is having as it evolves have for the institution that lead to every man for himself? Apprehended the potential over-personalism of Park's approach. The victory of exposure was Hodge's, but the Christian Examiner's allegiance to Park's more moving, if less solid, arguments was symbolic of the trend Hodge so tenaciously combated. So he's kind of fighting upstream because this is the zeitgeist is favoring Park's liberalism. Park had history on his side. The sentimental appeal, which he endowed with an intellectual integrity and conviction it was seldom to display again, won the day. Park's own students would de-emphasize the historical and scholarly work of biblical exegesis in the Andover curriculum, so that today Christianity is more associated with dimwits rather than serious men of intellect. In 1852, 2 years after Park's address on the theology of the intellect and of the feelings, the liberal Congregationalists, in a new effort to collect and define their forces, held a synod, like a meeting. It was the first official congregational gathering since the one in 1646 to 1648, at which the Cambridge Platform was formulated and ratified. The concern of the participants, unlike that of their long ago predecessors, was not with theology. They made plans to found the Congregational Library Association in Boston. Bella Edwards and Park were particularly influential here and laid the groundwork for the inception of the Congressional Quarterly. I'm sorry, the Congregational Quarterly. These were Congregationalists, and I had ancestors who were Congregationalist preachers up in that area. I like to think they were hardcore. Maybe they were super liberal, but somehow I doubt it. I'd like to imagine your ancestors and then invest them with imaginary virtues. Yes. I think I told you the story about my ancestors on the German side, who are maybe they were Germany or Switzerland, and their kid, they owned some pigs, and they were away, and their pigs broke into their house, undid the latch, and ate one of their kid's feet, and they subsequently left for America. Isn't that pathetic? These things happen, though. Even to those of us who imagine we are descended from glorious lines. A national council called in 1865 only further dramatized liberal discomfort with orthodox theology. The representatives vaguely endorsed, quote, the faith and order of the apostolic and primitive churches held by our fathers. On a special and rather ironic excursion to Plymouth Rock, however, they voted to delete the word Calvinism from the traditional congressional congregational statement of self-definition. So there's the Congregationalists decided at this synod that to dump the word Calvinism from their traditional statement of self-definition. 1852, that is. The penultimate chapter in a book on the triumphs of Congregationalism, published in 1894, was entitled, quote, Congregational Literature. Hodges' cynical suspicion about Park's direction, if not his motivation, was more than vindicated. So he's right. He said, if you do this, you're liberalizing this direction. Here's where it's going to end up. And it went even farther than he thought. Religion reduced to the merely literary. Attention to the claims of the press and interest in a rather nostalgic obfuscation of the past were preempting commitment to the older New England theology, for which Hodge claimed with justification to be a latter-day spokesman. That is, in the mid-1800s. Liberal Protestantism had moved one step nearer to the feminine subculture it both courted and feared. And that will wrap up. I'm calling this section, I'm calling it, she doesn't call it. It's a one subtitle, or a one subsection of chapter 4. This would be subsection C we've just completed on anti-intellectualism and the theology of feeling is what we've just completed. Very exciting stuff, I think. Showing you the intellectual history of Christianity in America and how that played into the development of the mass culture of anti-intellectualism and primacy of feeling over thought, which obviously play into the white educational context that we're discussing to understand how our race cannot see itself for what it is, cannot see its enemies for what they are, and cannot do battle, cannot offer battle with them because it's confused about who it is. And now we investigate the origins of how that, indirect however they may be, into how that confusion came about. Untangling the roots in historical Christianity in North America. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with me today. I've really enjoyed this and talking to you, and I hope you're getting some value out of it. And thanks to all those who've written me. I've had different people write me at times and mention that they've listened. I always appreciate that. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.